Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this OIES podcast. My name is James Henderson. I'm chairman of the GAS programme. And just before we start, I'll date stamp this recording, given what's going on in markets. It's 11th of October, and we're recording in the afternoon. And I'd like to welcome to the podcast three of my colleagues today, Jack Sharples and Mike Fullwood, as usual. And with us, I'm delighted, so we also have Jonathan Stern. And we're going to be talking about gas flows into Europe, levels of storage, as usual, also LNG flows and the outlook for the LNG market. With Jonathan, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the EU proposals for gas caps. And then we're going to finally talk about the outlook that was published by National Grid in the UK for the gas supply to the UK in the winter. There were some concerns that we might run out of gas, and we're going to discuss that topic at the end of the podcast. But first of all, let me come to Jack. Jack, perhaps you could give us an update since the last podcast a couple of weeks ago on pipeline flows to Europe.
Well, so obviously Europe gets its pipeline supplies from four different areas, from Norway, Russia, North Africa, and Azerbaijan. From North Africa and Azerbaijan, it's almost good. No news is good news, really. Supplies continue to be relatively stable, as they have been throughout the year. In terms of flows from Norway, during September, we saw plenty of maintenance offshore for Norway that significantly curtailed the pipeline flow of Norwegian gas into northwestern Europe. I'm very glad to say that once we got past the end of September, that maintenance was complete and the flows are back up now, very close to their peak, which is touching around 350 million cubic meters per day. Finally, with Russia, the pipeline flows from Russia are now constrained to just two routes, via Ukraine and via the Turkish Stream pipeline. And between them, we are getting around 65 million cubic meters per day. So a very significant year-on-year decline. To break that down as well, I think it's worth noting that the supplies delivered via Turkish Stream are now effectively ring-fenced into southeastern Europe, given that the gas crosses the border from Turkey into Bulgaria and is then delivered up to Serbia and Hungary, given that Serbia only really has pipeline connections onto Hungary. And since August, the Hungarian government has prohibited the re-export of gas. So for the rest of Europe as a whole, we're really only getting the supplies via Ukraine, which is about 35 million cubic meters per day and primarily directed to Slovakia, Austria and Italy.
So if I can just dig into those two remaining sources a little bit, Turkstream flows don't seem to have been affected that much. Is that right? And do you anticipate that continuing, or is there any sign of flows through Turkstream declining even a little?
No, I think we've seen the flows come down slightly. So they've dropped from probably around 40 million cubic meters per day down to around 35. But I think that's probably as much as anything to do with counterparty nominations rather than Gazprom's machinations, as it were. We've seen Greece is another country, by the way, that gets its Russian gas via that route. And the Greeks now seem to be turning their attention towards accessing LNG. But I would think looking forward, the Hungarians have clearly made their bet on continued supply from Russia, and the Serbians likewise. And I would imagine that the Russian government would be keen to reward that loyalty and would only sort of curtail those supplies under duress. By contrast, we've seen in recent weeks that there is, dare I say, a threat to the flow of Russian gas via Ukraine. To explain it briefly, Gazprom holds a transit contract with Naftogaz, which used to be the vertically integrated entity in Ukraine. And when the operation of the transmission system was spun off to GTSOU, Gas Transmission System of Ukraine, Gazprom didn't want to hold a counterparty contract with them. So Gazprom has a contract with Naftogaz, and Naftogaz books the capacity domestically. And recently, Gazprom effectively threatened Naftogaz that if Naftogaz continued with its commercial arbitration case against Gazprom, that Naftogaz could find itself placed under Russian government sanctions, which would, of course, prevent Gazprom from fulfilling its part of the obligation, which, as we, you know, would take the implied threat that gas transit via Ukraine could cease.
Okay, that's interesting. So one line fairly secure, one line under some what would appear relatively significant threat. Let me turn now to LNG. I mean, I'll talk to Mike in a sec about the sort of detail, but Jack, tell me, LNG has really been replacing a lot of that Russian gas. What's been the situation with Sendai in particular over the last few weeks?
Well, I think it's very interesting to note that through through almost the entirety of 2022, LNG send-out has actually outpaced pipeline supply from Norway and pipeline supply from Russia. When we consider that the absolute maximum technical capacity of Norwegian pipeline supply is around 350 million cubic meters per day, LNG send-out has averaged, by monthly average, has averaged more than that in all but 1 month so far this year. And even in August, when it fell down to 330 million cubic meters per day, that was still higher than what we were getting from Norway. So definitely the European market is exposed to the global dynamics of LNG like never before.
Okay, well, that LNG has been flooding in and obviously been helpful to replenish storage. Winter has officially started on the 1st of October, but it still seems relatively warm where I live in eastern England. How are we fixed for storage in Europe? Are we still injecting or have withdrawals started yet?
So we're still injecting, which is good news. If you take the figure from the 1st of April to the 1st of October, so for the summer month, then we actually have managed to inject almost 20 BCM more year on year. So we've injected about 65 BCM during those summer months compared to around 45 BCM last year and 43 BCM in 2020. So we're getting back towards the record summer injection of 67 BCM made in 2018 in the aftermath from the Beast from the East. So that puts us in good shape regarding storage stocks. On the 1st of October, we hit 93 BCM. And according to the latest data from about 2 days ago, we were pretty close to 95 BCM, which takes us over 90% of storage capacity. So we're definitely moving in the right direction. And hopefully that will continue in the next several weeks.
Okay, so that's pretty positive news. Mike, let me come to you now and talk a little bit more about that LNG situation. Can you give us a little bit more detail about, you know, how and why so much LNG continues to flood into Europe?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same I've been saying probably the last few podcasts. I mean, the European volumes pretty strong again in September. Sort of year to date, they're up around about 47 BCM compared to the previous year, 9 months to September. That includes UK and Turkey volumes. UK volumes have been particularly strong. It's the story about China not really wanting the LNG. Since February, the average imports to China have been about 6.5 billion cubic metres. That's 2 billion cubic metres a month less than the previous year. The preliminary October numbers look like it may pick up slightly, but nothing material. But Europe's continuing to get a tsunami of LNG sort of coming towards it. The Southeast Asia volumes have been very, very strong through the year, especially Thailand. They're looking a little bit weaker in October. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh still sort of fairly weak. Japan, Korea, Taiwan also sort of flattish. And volumes seem to be even lower in Central and South America. So it all looks as though Europe can look forward to getting continuing to get a lot more LNG heading into the winter. So we're going to achieve quite easy to imagine the 50 BCM increase year on year, which kind of looked out of reach certainly sort of 7-8 months ago.
Okay, well, given that optimistic story, I mean, here we sit on the 11th of October, and, you know, with that amount of LNG coming in spite of the Russian cut to production, how are prices looking? Have we seen some softening at all?
We have, yes. I think they've been really coming off since the beginning of September when they sort of spiked up again on the back of Nord Stream being completely closed. There's a little bit of ups and downs as the holes appeared in the Nord Stream pipelines, but given no gas was flowing, that was just a little blip. And then the prospect, as Jack was talking about, the possibility of Ukraine flows being stopped also caused a few blips. But it's been really on a sort of downward trend, and we're now back to sort of where we were in June, July, when Nord Stream was slowly being wound down. And now, obviously, the weather's getting colder and demand is getting higher. I think there's been a realisation that with the very strong LNG flows, and as Jack talked about, storage building almost to capacity, that certainly the short-term prospects for this winter are now looking a lot rosier. And that, you know, even in the absence of any additional Russia flows or possibly even with Ukraine possibly cutting off, that we could actually squeak through this winter if it's mild, without any material demand rationing, especially in sort of central European countries and Germany. So I think that has taken the edge off prices. So I mean, obviously earlier in the year, there was when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a huge risk premium in the price, the fact that Russia flows will potentially get cut off. Now Russia flows have got so low that the risk premium of Russia flows being cut off is diminished markedly, because there's not so much risk, there's not so much flows to get cut off. So I think we are getting back to price levels which are closer to what we might call the sort of the supply demand balance. There's still some risk premium in there, but it's a little bit more normalisation.
So can I just ask you to put some numbers on that? I mean, what are we talking about in terms of the TTF price and then the NBP price and indeed the LNG import price?
Yeah, we're looking at, I always did dollars a million BTU. I mean, the TTF sort of front month's now down in the mid-40s, dollars a million BTU. It was up at 60 plus dollars a few weeks ago. NBP is down about $30, and the LNG price is sort of similar. The LNG price in Northwest Europe is actually sort of very similar to the JKM price. So the sort of LNG market there, which is slightly divorced from TTF because of the congestion in the regas terminals.
Okay, Mike, thanks for that. I mean, we've got Jonathan Stone with us here today as well. And Jonathan, I'd like to come to you if I may. I mean, the gas prices have come off, as Mike said, but I mean, at $40 for TTF, clearly we're still, you know, tens of multiples higher than we were in 2020 during the pandemic. And, you know, Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has announced various measures around price caps in the last week or so. Could you just kind of talk us through the current thinking for the EU on prices?
Yes. So Mrs. von der Leyen's proposals were really sort of threefold. The one that I think is, I should say, least controversial is the decoupling of gas prices from the formation of power prices. And I think that is got a lot of traction. There's a question about how that could be done. It could be done a number of different ways. But the idea that power prices in a large number of European countries should still be dependent on the gas price, I think it's now accepted that that is something that needs to be changed. The more controversial propositions she put forward are a corridor of decent gas prices with our reliable suppliers, with a reference to the talks underway with the Norwegian companies, and a limit on the market price of gas, taking out the peaks and speculation at the TTF. And I'm not sure that anyone really understands how that would be done, particularly when she says such a cap must be designed properly to ensure security of supply, and it's a temporary solution to cater for the fact that the TTF is no longer representative of a market that includes more LNG today. And she goes on to say, longer term, a new EU gas price index would ensure a better functioning of the market. And those are all sort of very interesting statements, but it's not clear, as in fact the Commission working level people in their non-paper a few days later on, it's not really clear what any of those could mean.
So just to pick you up on a couple of those points, the decoupling gas from power prices, is that a sort of replica of what's been going on in the Iberian Peninsula? And I mean, if it is, there were some critics of that, particularly around what it does for gas demand. Any thoughts on that?
So what's been done in the Iberian Peninsula is one particular example of that. But in fact, this is, I think, a more fundamental question of how power prices should be set, given that you've got what are referred to as the inframarginal or the low carbon sources, where the costs haven't gone up at all, but the profits with these electricity prices have gone up massively. And also that these inframarginal sources, particularly renewables, are taking up an increasing percentage of the market. And so there are a number of different ways to deal with this. I mean, in the OIS, we've had David Robinson and Malcolm Kay propose a two-market solution. Others are proposing an average price. Others are proposing locational prices. So depending on where you live, if you were near a massive source of renewables, you'd pay less. If you were nearer the fossil sources of generation, you'd pay more. But there's a number of ways of doing this. And what's been done in the Iberian Peninsula is only one way.
Okay, I mean, the second point I want to pick up on is you mentioned the non-paper, which was published at the end of September. And for those listeners who aren't aware, EU non-papers are kind of float ideas that aren't necessarily going to be passed into regulation or for specific approval. But that non-paper highlighted a number of drawbacks associated with price caps and kind of questioned whether they're workable or not. So where does that kind of leave us relative to the president's kind of proposals?
I think the president's proposals can be seen as what the politicians are saying, and the non-paper can be seen as what the professionals are saying in the commission. But what's odd about, if people want to look at the non-paper, you have to get past what the actual paper. And then there's a page and a half, which is called an annex, where they say, a cap applicable to hubs, OTC and exchanges would not only intervene in contractual relations with third country importers, but also limit the pricing of intra-EU transactions. In other words, it would no longer give price signals between countries, which would be serious because in some countries, the infrastructure exists to move gas further on. And in other countries, that's desperately needed. I mean, it also says deciding on gas flows administratively is without precedent in Europe. There is no body which has the experience and technical capability to undertake this task. Now, engaging in such a measure would require an upfront political decision on the method to allocate gas to member states and the criteria to be used. And establishing the appropriate level of the cap would be a challenging exercise due to internal and global market dynamics, and so on and so on. In other words, having sort of set out what politicians would like to do, it then says, well, we don't really know how to do this, you know, given the problems that it would cause, giving us really the idea of, is this going to cause more problems than it's going to solve?
Okay, so given that confusion, the next question I'd like to ask you is, you know, individual member states are starting to go off and do their own things. And although not directly related to a price cap, and we've obviously seen the example of the enormous subsidy that the German government has basically allocated to protect consumers in that country and the reaction to that from other EU members, which obviously raises questions of solidarity as well as price caps. Can you say, I mean, how are those two related and what do you think the impact of that is on the whole debate?
So really, member states, you know, if we for the moment set aside solidarity, which, you know, it's a question of whether we should do that. But if we do, member states have really got two options. Either they just continue to bear the cost of subsidizing their customers and voters, critically. And they do that because they have to protect people from hardship and companies from bankruptcy. And they have to try and focus on those who genuinely can't pay. Or they impose a price cap, a wholesale price cap, in addition to the retail price cap. And the poorer member states might do that because they simply don't have the money to subsidize all of their customers through long periods of time. Now, the Germans have clearly laid down a marker to say, we do have the money to subsidize, at least for the next year or so. Whereas 15 member states who are supporting the price cap, the majority of them, either in the extreme north or extreme south of Europe, are saying, we don't have the money to do this, and we want a price cap. The problem, as we just go back to what we said earlier, is a price cap going to solve your problem, or is it just going to mean you're going to get less gas? So it's a really difficult issue, and it threatens solidarity within the union, but also it finally gets to the question of, what is the problem and what is a solution to the problem? And that's the difficult question.
And do you think there's a risk then that individual member states will kind of go off and do their own things, that we might see multiple price caps at different levels? Or is it, do you think we're always going to see an EU solution overall?
Well, the EU obviously does not want different solutions, because that really creates real problems between, in terms of not just solidarity, but the physical flow of gas between countries. But the danger is, if you're in Southern Europe and you're not a very rich country, and this situation goes on for a year, I mean, you know, we've heard Mike and Jack talk about that we may get through this winter, but what about next winter? What about, well, how are we going to put gas into storage over the summer for next winter? If this goes on for a year, you just may not have the individual governments may not have the money to sustain these level of subsidies. At that point, what do they do? Do they allow their voters to go into hardship with obvious consequences, or do they impose a price cap kind of in desperation and just see what happens? That is really unresolved.
Okay, well, I think let us move on now. Mike, let me come back to you, if I may. I'd like to talk about a country that's now obviously outside the EU after Brexit, the UK, and some of the impacts that are being discussed in this country. And we had the kind of winter outlook from National Grid, the transmission system operator, in the last week or so, which highlighted the risk of gas shortages under certain scenarios this winter. Can you give us a quick review, Mike, of what was said and how big you think the risk of a gas shortage in the UK actually is?
Yes, the winter gas outlook, National Grid, that sort of for a few days afterwards, the sort of leaked Ofgem letter, which pointed to a significant risk of gas shortages. And I think the National Grid did their best to sort of allay some of the fears. I mean, they looked at a couple of scenarios. One was a sort of a normal winter, and then one was a sort of cold winter going back to the 2010-11 winter, which actually was a bit colder and sort of higher relative gas demand than the recent cold winter we had in 2020-21. So it was a more of an, not extreme one, but a higher gas demand one. In that scenario, they because normally, if this should be as normal, the UK would export to the EU down the interconnectors in the summer and re-import that gas back in the winter. We didn't do that last winter, but in the cold winter scenario, it's clear from the National Grid charts that to meet that peak, you would need to import gas from the EU in the sort of December, January peak periods, probably at the same time that the EU is also short of gas because they're probably having cold weather as well, and obviously doubly short of gas for lack of Russian flows. So that raised the prospect in a cold winter of possible gas shortages. And that was with very, very high flows of LNG, although not necessarily to the full capacity of the our LNG terminals. In a normal winter, then the need to import from the continent was zero. So with LNG continuing to come in, a normal winter would seem to be comfortable to be able to get through, but the cold winter wasn't. So that was in a nutshell what the National Grid was saying. I think I would generally agree with that. I think the risk of gas shortages is probably relatively low, maybe 5 or 10% at most. So I don't think it's a significant risk. Depends on the cold weather, but providing LNG keeps coming, we probably should be okay. The real risk is going back to the LNG market and China suddenly starts to rebound, possibly cold weather there, higher economic activity starts to pull LNG away. But that risk, I think, is receding given China's shown very little sign of doing that.
Okay, so although the volumetric risk then appears to be relatively low other than in a very cold winter, I mean, this is all obviously at a price. And as you've mentioned, you know, the normal level of price now would appear to be around $30 to $40. So I don't think there's no sign of those prices going down over winter.
No, so certainly not. I mean, in fact, prices are sort of the forward curve sort of heading up towards the winter, which is what it normally does. But yes, I mean, the UK should be fine at a price. Ron, it's competitive. And I think that's the conclusion we would come to, that the UK will certainly be prepared to pay the prices. They've been lower than continental Europe prices. I think the prospect for price cap in the wholesale price in the UK is probably very, very, very low.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Now, Jonathan, let me come to you. I know you were listening into the National Grid presentation as well. Have you got any final thoughts on the future of gas supply this winter for the UK and indeed energy, electricity supply overall?
Yeah, I think the general view from the National Grid was that what they called a reasonable worst case scenario would be that we might see rolling blackouts of 3 hours for groups of customers in different regions, but that this would be manageable. Customers would get 24 hours notice. It would be rotational by region, so you wouldn't be cut off all the time. And in general, they were giving us a reasonably upbeat view of what the winter would entail. So there were various different caveats about vulnerable customers, but in general, I would say it was a very upbeat example of the National Grid having done its homework and saying to people, you know what, we're probably going to be okay. So I think in general, pretty good.
Okay, well, that's a very upbeat note on which to finish the podcast. Jack, Mike, Jonathan, thank you very much for your contributions. As always, I just mentioned you can find the previous podcast in this series and also all our research on the outlook for the European gas market, indeed the global gas market as a result of the Russia-Ukraine war on our website. But with that, thank you very much indeed for listening. Please stay healthy and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.